Group meeting, Saturday, 10th March, 1984. We have tried during our meetings from September, last September, to free the mind from various unwarrantable beliefs, convictions, ideas, superstitions, and so on. Because as and when the mind realizes, that is to say, makes real this freedom, it becomes much easier for a person to see truth directly. And seeing truth directly means to be conscious of the truth. We have ideas about what we call truth. We say such and such is the truth. What we have said in so many words is a concept or a series of concepts. Now, such concepts and such words try to represent the truth, but they are only attempting to represent, and the representation is somewhat like a sketch made by an artist or a portrait by a painter or something like that. They themselves, of course, are not the truth, but people are so deluded, naturally, we can't help that. We are so deluded that we think, we've got the truth now. Here is the teacher, or that one was the founder of the religion, and he has given us the last word, which is the truth. It is not the truth. Each of us as a living being is utterly unique. One of the purposes of existence of each human being is to realize the culminating point of the evolution of consciousness. Knowing by the brain, even going to the extent of being an instrument of that universal energy which we call mind, is not the end point. It is on the way. And the end point, as far as the culmination of the evolution of is the culmination of consciousness itself. Now this culmination means that when one is conscious, actually conscious of the truth, free of mere ideas or beliefs or convictions about it, then one is that truth. Because the ultimate reality about us human beings is our consciousness. The primordial creative energy functioning in a certain way which brings about knowing and the whole process of the growth of knowledge and experience and all the rest of it, that when that creative energy functions in a certain way, it is what we call consciousness. Not we misunderstand as consciousness, but the name consciousness is the right name for it. And that conscious, to be conscious, means to be that which we are conscious of. Now, of course, immediately the difficult question arises, if I look at a house or a tree or something, I am conscious that there is a tree or there is a house, but I don't become the tree or become the house. That is perfectly true in a limited way. Because when I say I don't become the tree or the house, I have a certain idea about myself as the separate, isolated observer, different from the tree or the house. Now, in our ordinary everyday context of the finite and the temporal, this is perfectly true, that there is this separation. But as and when consciousness begins to flower out in us, what happens is that just as we can contain, our consciousness can contain what we call ourself, the psychophysical organism, as itself, we are conscious of that, then our consciousness, as we call it, can take in the tree as part and parcel of the self. This is an extraordinary experience altogether. I'm trying to put into words what has always proved extremely difficult to put into words. Because you see, before one can put a thing into words, there is a thought process in the brain, a conceptualizing process, which is the imaginative activity of the brain. That is to say, the brain makes an image of that which is conveyed to it through the sense functions. And the brain believes that that image which it has made is the truth, the fact about what has been conveyed through the senses. This is where the greatest difficulty comes in. And this is what we have to transcend gradually through, we can call it through religious living, through yoga, or anything else. And we say that that is a path to the truth. But be very careful. Don't call it a path to the truth. There is no path to the truth. Because a path implies a starting point here for me, the person, and a goal there, the object, the ultimate realization. There is no such thing in actuality. Because the actuality, the unitary whole context, is one which is infinite, eternal, immortal. There is no here. There is no there. There is no distance, no separation in terms of the infinite. There is no past, no present, no future in terms of eternity. I include no present. Note that carefully, because most people say the eternal now is eternity. I say no present for this reason, because I, the imperfect mortal who has not yet realized the supreme fulfillment, the now represents a dividing point between what this same brain will call future and past. Get it? You see, therefore all that is clean out as and when the supreme realization in consciousness occurs. This is one of the reasons, perhaps the main reason, why in the Varaha Upanishad you find an extraordinary revelation where Brahman is completely identified with absolute consciousness and also, therefore, with Atma. See, we use words like Atma, or in European languages, the immortal spirit or soul or whatever word you like to use, with the implication and with the feeling in one's own brain that the Atma is a something which is a separate particular entity belonging to and residing in the living psychophysical organism. Now these are all illusions. Of course I say so. I may be wrong. You find out whether I'm right or wrong. And in attempting to find out, if you succeed in finding out, you will find out that neither am I right nor am I wrong, but you will find out your own truth, your own reality. You see, if one can succeed, in realizing this state, then the words which have been spoken now are prophetic speech. They prophesy your flowering, your fulfillment in the supreme sense, which is not the fulfillment of you, the finite, temporal, mortal, psychophysical organism, but the fulfillment of the totality of existence. You see, the great mystics, the great founders of the religions, realized this consciously. Maybe I am putting it into words which are less inadequate, less misleading than the words of many who have spoken or written about this. Simply because, up to a small extent, I have a little gift for clarification, although I use words which are the most mystifying thing in the world. So you see, this is what we have to awaken to. If we awake to it, then the realization, the making real, the having made real is there. And in that reality, you are utterly free of all anxiety, of all questioning, of all seeking for answers which tell you the truth. The truth is the untellable, but the truth is that which you can be, that which you can do. That is the truth. When, for instance, you get out of your newborn stage, when you pass the condition of the neonate, the newborn, and you begin to move about a little bit, you toddle, you then learn to balance on your own feet, you walk, and then you can run, and so forth. And in the act of running, consciousness has completely come to fulfillment in terms of action. To be conscious, therefore, in the supreme sense, is really to be doing. And what is the doing for the living physical organism, psychophysical organism? The living process itself. People say that all the functions of the body, digesting and assimilating and eliminating and all that sort of thing, is carried on unconsciously. I say the reverse. I say this is the complete fulfillment of consciousness. It's manifested in the actual fact which is there. Now this is I admit it's just my own view of it. Again, I may be wrong, or I may be right. I believe in this case I'm nearer right than wrong. I won't say I'm absolutely right, because I'd be a very great fool if I said I was absolutely right with respect to anything. So now, Let us consider for a while that which we call action. Because I've been talking about doing, being and doing, which means action, of course. And I'm constantly talking of the creative energy. The functioning of the creative energy is constant creative action. How do we regard action? How are we, as we are at present constituted, conscious of action? We are conscious of it in little bits. Oh, we did that at 6 o'clock, we are going to do this at 10 o'clock, and so on and so on. And so-and-so did this, and so-and-so did that, all in little bits. Now, each of these little bits is a holographic representation of the totality of the universal action. Don't try with the brain to picture it. It's utterly impossible. When it comes to you, it will come as a terrific lightning flash of revelation. The living process of the entire cosmos is the meaning of action in the supreme sense. It's the real meaning of the word karma. We dealt with karma during past months, and I've tried to show the mistaken notions we have of it and so forth. But try and become aware. We can become, whatever our stage of development may be, we can become aware in some degree or other of this extraordinary fact that the living process of the universe, of the cosmos, is a continuous action. It is both continuous and discontinuous. This is to satisfy the dear scientists who understand discontinuity very well. But that it is a fact that it is both continuous and discontinuous. The discontinuity in anything is the holographic representation of the continuity. So you see, we look at it this way, I as I am, not evolved to the supreme point as a psychophysical being, am aware in terms of separateness, of isolation, in terms of little bits composing my whole environment, my whole world, my whole cosmos. There is that star, there is this galaxy, there is that house, and so on and so on. Everything is separate. This is the fundamental meaning of my sinful state. We are all born like that, gradually getting aware in terms of separateness. In becoming aware in terms of separateness, there is always, therefore, conflict, disharmony. Not a cosmos, but a chaos in its secondary sense of disorder. We can't avoid this, you see. This is how it has happened in the course of evolution. This is how it will go on for a very, very long time yet, before the human race is able to wake up to the sense of the unitary wholeness of the cosmos. So, I myself being unaware in terms of the totality, actually, all the time. In other words, I'm not conscious in terms of infinity and eternity. See action as little bits everywhere. Now, all this, if tackled by the individual or approached by the individual in the creative, constructive, the right way, he will arrive at the awareness of everything in terms of unitary wholeness, which means holiness, which means well-being, because holiness and health are one and the same thing. You see, all the people in the world, which one of them is constantly perfectly healthy, even as a psychophysical organism? No one. We all get ill. If it is only a cold or something, then we hear of these people who say, "Oh, I never had an illness in my life, and then I died of." Oh, no, you can't. He can't speak of his own death. But you see, there is nothing which is entirely healthy, entirely whole, because it is not conscious in terms of unitary wholeness, not conscious of the fact that the totality is infinite and eternal. We are aware in terms of space and time, in terms of separation. But space and time, if one becomes aware of them in their wholeness, becomes infinity and eternity. Now you see, if you can feel the quietness, the stillness, whilst you are listening, whilst you are talking, if you can sense that even in some small degree, you will suddenly feel the transmutation, not a mere transformation, which is a changing of the form. But changing of the form, the stuff is the same. But a transmutation into something which is utterly indescribable. And it is not there, it is not tomorrow, it is not the next hour, it is right here immediately. That word immediate is a wonderful word. It means without mediation, without something in between. That which mediates is that which is in between this and that. Isn't that so? Take the activity of ACAS, for instance, in the country. They are mediators. They are the in-betweens. But they don't succeed, really, in bringing about a unitary wholeness. They are constantly at work, constantly active, and yet there is no unitary wholeness in the country. It's a question of consciousness. ACAS deals with ideas, with desires, with demands, and so on and so on. And all those things are the things which spoil the unity all along the line. So their activity, while trying to be the immediate thing, which is a non-mediation, is actually just putting off the day of redemption. you must try and work this out in your own mind when you're by yourself. And you'll find extraordinary things emerging. Look into your own life so far. Look into your own life and see how the immediacy has never had a chance of fruition in the real sense. Now, when an action is over, if it is a perfect action, then karma, as we call it, is entirely finished. There is no leftover. You know, Hinduism has, and Buddhism too, have talked in terms of past karma, present karma, and the karma to come, the leftover. As if karma goes particularly through a time channel, or a time tunnel, shall I say, because a tunnel is better because it is dark. It does not go through a time tunnel. Karma acts at once. It is immediate. My consciousness, not being sufficiently developed, cannot keep pace with the actual immediacy of that process. And I think in terms of, oh, that's the past karma, this is the present karma, and so much is left over, and there's a future karma. Nothing of the sort. If consciousness were unitarily whole, what one is conscious of now and is doing now is done completely, utterly finished with. There is no future karma involved in it. You know, the Greeks tried to have some idea about this, and I don't think they really succeeded. So they presented the idea of, for people's wrongdoing, Nemesis, the goddess Nemesis, will catch up with you, the punisher. Punishing or rewarding does not produce wholeness at all. They are man's illusions. We call punishing that which hurts us. We call rewarding that which pleases us. But that which hurts one person may please another person. One person may have the digestion of a horse and eat and drink and be merry to an extent which would make a man of good sense completely faint with horror. And another person may take liberties, and before he knows where he is, he has to go to the doctor. You see, the same thing, eating and drinking, has punished one and rewarded another with pleasure. None of those things make for wholeness. We must realize this. We seek pleasure all the time to get away from it, because we are unable to deal in terms of complete wholeness with the actuality present. But if one deals with that completely, then there is no karma at all. See, the word karma comes from kri. The root is kri, to create. And we must understand that creation is not mere making. Mere making is a putting together of the jigsaw puzzle, so to say. That's what the mere making is, including the making of the most marvelous machines and whatnot. But that is not creating. Creating literally is producing out of no thing, out of nothing. Just in the last number of The New Scientist, there is an article which talks about the creation of the universe out of nothing. It's a difficult article, but it's a very interesting article. You see, creation means that. So now, because our action is usually not a whole action, although physically it may be over, there is always a memory in connection with it. It is very easy if we just look through our own life story. Look at all the memories that are stored up and how they come up. Some of them please us, many of them hurt us, those memories. Now, the pleasing us is like the singing of the siren. It is something which makes one want more pleasure. This is the very devil. We have to be extremely careful about this. But this memory aspect plays a part which can be helpful. It can save one from repeating a previous mistake. It can do that. It can also develop a technique, a capacity for skillful right action. Because when a similar circumstance, no circumstance is ever exactly the same as a previous circumstance, but when a similar circumstance comes into being, the memory may enable us to know how to do the thing in a less mistaken way. Now we have an extremely good example of that in the development of various skills as artists by constant repetition, but repetition which is intelligent repetition, we master what we want to do. Take a simple case like learning to play a piano. You repeat and repeat and repeat, and you train your fingers, your hand, your whole body, as a matter of fact, in producing the music which you want to produce, you see. And you remember, as you practice it again and again, what were the difficulties and the flaws in the previous practice. And so you can be free of them. What is happening? Consciousness is beginning to function more and more intimately. It is waking us up to the actual beauty of the sound which is required. And so with constant practice, the thing becomes perfect. Wasn't it Francis Bacon who said, "Practice maketh perfect"? Something like that. Now, there's another aspect of memory, the play of memory. It may incite you to repeat the action again and again in order to obtain a desired satisfaction which was not obtained before. Or if a full satisfaction was obtained before, to repeat that satisfaction. Take the man who becomes an alcoholic. He gets a certain satisfaction. He's dead drunk. He's absolutely dead to the world as such. But he has experienced some wonderful ecstasy about it. A lunatic ecstasy. I think that is the best way to describe it. He has experienced a lunatic ecstasy about it. And he wants to reproduce it again. Oh, that was a wonderful thing, you know. And he goes and does the same thing. What he doesn't wake up to is that he as a subhuman is driving himself to the stage of becoming inhuman. That is what he doesn't wake up to. We must realize that an action is not merely a material doing. It's not merely that. There is the material aspect of it, but an action in the actual doing involves the psyche very much, because all those psychological forces, desire, pleasure, pain, fear, attraction, revulsion, love, hate, gain, grasping, etc., etc. All those psychical elements play their part in any action. We are unconscious of them. We don't know them. Because we don't know how to observe, how to be fully observant. An action also involves consciousness. Is it functioning as a pure and complete awareness, or is it self-centered, isolative, and separative? These are the elements which we must look into whilst performing any action. How are we conscious with respect to that action? If consciousness is obstructed by a conditioned brain, that is, by a fixed set of ideas and beliefs, practically all of which are unwarranted in truth, it will not be an impartial, true seeing awareness. It will be a slanted awareness. If it is obstructed by the psyche, consciousness will be clouded over by illusions, like a fly enwrapped in a spider's web. So we must be very careful of the psychical activities there. The whims, the passions, the feelings, the attractions, the thought, what we may call our general thoughtlessness. Better than thoughtlessness, our general unwisdom. Because thought is not necessarily wise or always clear-sighted. And so there will be no chance for choiceless awareness, for enlightenment. Pure consciousness doesn't take sides anywhere in the universal process. It is just aware. This is how it is happening. Complete awareness. So, try and imagine yourself. We'll use a theistic formulation. You are God, the creator of this entire cosmos. In what manner are you conscious of your cosmos? If you are God, you are conscious of it in terms of infinity and eternity, in which there is no characteristic, no evaluation, no beginning, ending, proceeding, or anything like that. If you were God in reality, that's how you'd be conscious. Therefore, you cannot take sides. You would not take sides. You, God, are the creator or the devil. Look, I think in the February meetings, I read you that passage from Deuteronomy. Anybody remember? Chapter 13, verse 30, verse 15, I think. It comes in Deuteronomy. And the Lord God says unto Moses, Behold, I have set before you life and death, good and evil. I, God, have set before you the opposites. And I, God, do nothing about it. Not my business, that's your business. You, in meaning me and you and everybody else, you see, it is our business to do the doings. Very unfair of God, isn't it? But that is divine justice. Just as to allow the crucifixion, to allow the horror and... Oh, I've been reading about the terrible horrors perpetrated by the Muslim world in world history. And they're simply awful, you see. But the Lord God allows it. Allah allows it. In fact, asks for it through the Quran. Strange. And yet peculiarly true. This complete freedom of consciousness, the supreme spiritual freedom, is something which completely transcends everything that we know here in terms of the finite and the temporal and the mortal. Completely transcends all that. We were created in the living likeness of Elohim. Now, since Elohim is like that, that is what we are growing into. Those who are fathers and mothers here, can we bring up our children that way? We can't. For us, it is a belief, an idea, after all. What I'm saying, in so many words, is a audible formulation of a concept, of concepts. And yet, concepts can have a relationship with absolute reality. They can, but just a relationship. It's like lightning. I think in Mahayana, in the Diamond Sutra, is it somewhere? There comes like a lightning flash, like a firefly, and so forth. There is that. So, since you, God, are choicelessly aware, you don't take sides, you are choicelessly aware of the entire cosmos, you are enlightened. Because you know that all that turmoil and struggle will change, undergo change, which is the unchanging, immutable fact of the entire cosmic process. And through that change, there will come about that which has to come about, which I won't try to put into words, at least now. This is very hard. It is really very hard. It's terribly austere. I've been told by very good friends again and again, what you say is too austere. People won't take to it. Well, of course, I don't want people to take to it. I want them to be troubled by it. That is all. Really troubled. Then, when one is in that terrible state, a really terrible state, haven't you experienced people saying, if not in actual life, on the films, what are you doing about it? Do something about it, for goodness sake, and so on and so on. Because when you are troubled, you really do something about it. If not, that is the end of you. And it just doesn't matter if it is the end of you, or the beginning of you, or the fruition of you, or the damnation of you. You see, we are so conceited that, no, I must realize the truth, I must be the great servant of the Lord and all that sort of rubbish. The Lord is not in need of servants. He can't pay them for one thing. So, until consciousness has really begun to awake properly, states of mind, moods, feelings, thoughts, speech, and daily deeds will be anything but pure, true, good, wise, beautiful. They will be anything but truly human, because we actually are only in the subhuman state. The true humans were the perfected holy ones. That is the fruition. So now, how do we move out of this state of being blind children of mortality into that of truth-seeking, deathless, truth-seeing, deathless humanity, from bondage and sorrow into freedom and bliss? The answer is very simple. And in proportion to its utter simplicity is its incredible difficulty. Use the senses rightly and fully. Don't indulge them. Use them rightly and fully. You know, in past years I have time and again said, never take leave of good sense. But out of the 4,000 millions in the world, where will you find the people, and how many will they be, who never take leave of good sense? But we all do it. I do it. Put it in another form. Be wholly observant, which includes being completely and skillfully active. Not rushing about doing good and joining societies and, you know, making demonstrations. It's a tamasha, all these demonstrations. They are a terrible and a wonderful tamasha, and it makes the angels in heaven just laugh at mankind. When there is no leftover, no karma to be worked out, there is complete action which is pure consciousness. And then omniscient mind needs no memory.